Fans, it's great to have you back with us as we get ready for Giants baseball. What a pleasure to bring Jim Cott to the show. Of course, we know him this year as a Hall of Fame inductee, and he had an amazing major league career. Let me just tell you a little bit about Jim, because there's a new book out, Good as Gold, My Eight Decades in Baseball. For Jim Cott, he won 283 games in the big leagues, 237 on the loss side, 625 games started, 16 consecutive gold gloves. He pitched until he was 44 years old, 25 seasons, of course, in the big leagues. In his career, 4,530 innings pitched, 3.45 ERA, 2,400-plus strikeouts, Minnesota Twins record 189 wins, 1,004 games, 24 as a pinch hitter, 85 as a pinch runner, and as I said, 25 seasons in Major League Baseball, and he is now a member of the Hall of Fame. Jim, great to have you with us. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Marty. Thanks for that glowing list of statistics.
Well, you earned it, so it's a pleasure to have you on. The book is Good as Gold, My Eight Decades in Baseball, and that should tell you enough about the story. His co-author is Douglas Lyons. Jim has written before, and Doug Lyons is a lawyer in New York City, and he's got a long list of baseball books that he's done. And this is one where the numbers come to life. The numbers of baseball reference and things like that come to life with the stories of Jim's life in baseball. So, Jim, tell me about the book. How did it come about and why now?
Well, I had written one several years ago with Phil Pepe, Still Pitching, which meant I was done pitching baseball, but I was still pitching in the broadcast booth. And then I did one on If These Walls Could Talk about covering the Yankees as an announcer. And people said, well, you should write another book. My partner, Bob Costas, had said, well, you have to work some games in 2020 because then your career will touch eight decades. And I don't know how many people, you know, as a player and announcer have had that length of time. So that's where I got the idea of Doug and I got together and just said, let's break up decade by decade, put some highlights in there from each one and experiences. And then my likes and dislikes and a little bit about my golf travel. So, you know, it covered a lot of topics. But I thought at 83, you know, you have to kind of make a judgment between living and living a quality life where you could do a book like this. And I thought now might be the time to do it.
Well, you did a great job with it. As I say, the statistics are there. As I mentioned, all the years in the big leagues, the 283 wins, Hall of Fame, of course, 2022. But the story begins really in a little town in Michigan, Zeeland, Michigan. And your dad had a major part of your development as a ball player, and he was a great fan. And that's part of the story. Let's talk about your dad and baseball.
Yeah, I could spend the next half hour doing that, Marty, okay. But I like to say I fell in love with baseball on June 26, 1946. My dad took me to Detroit. I saw a doubleheader between the Red Sox and the Tigers. I saw Ted Williams, Bobby Doerr, Hank Greenberg, Hal Newhouser, all future Hall of Famers. But what got my attention when I walked up the ramp to find our seats as a little more than a seven-year-old boy, I saw this dark green cathedral called Briggs Stadium and the greenest carpet of grass I'd ever seen and the whitest uniforms. And I was just mesmerized. I said, man, my little brain said, I think I want to be out there. And then, you know, in 1947, my dad actually with my parents drove to Cooperstown so he could attend the induction of his favorite player, Lefty Grove. I just had my picture taken by Lefty's plaque at my orientation. So, yeah, he was such an avid fan and an influence on my life and my career. And so that's really where I got my interest and desire for baseball.
Well, you end up signing with the Washington Senators, and fans who don't know the Washington Senators, they were the original team in Washington, then became the Minnesota Twins, where they are now. But, Jim, you signed with the Senators. Now, you're a good high school prospect. You probably could have gotten a lot more money, but you ended up signing with the Senators in the mid-50s, 57, actually. How come the Senators? That's part of the story.
Well, Dick Wincik, the area scout from Kalamazoo, Michigan, area scout for the Senators, had watched me pitch some games for Hope College, small college in southwestern Michigan, offered me a tryout, subsequently said, well, offered a $4,000 package to go to Superior, Nebraska, in the Class D All-Rookie League. In the meantime, Pete Melito, the White Sox scout, called my dad and said, we heard your son's going to sign. I think we can get him $25,000. Because I think he'll be in the big leagues in 2 years. Well, the requirement there was if you signed for more than $4,000, you had to occupy a spot on the active 25-man roster. Not many 18-year-olds were ready to do that, but teams did invest in some big bonus money to players. I think the only two that really became Hall of Famers by getting a big bonus early, and it took their careers a little while to develop, were Sandy Koufax and then my teammate Harmon Killebrew. So my dad thanked Pete because he followed this history of the fallen bonus babies, and he said, Jim's going to take the four and go to the minor leagues and learn how to be a professional player, and there's a lot of room for advancement with the Senators. They didn't have much left-handed pitching. And, you know, later on it hit me that my dad made $72 a week. So when you do the math, he gave up an awful lot of money just to, you know, make sure that I started my career at the right level. You know, I did make it to the big leagues in 2 years, but without that minor league experience, especially for pitching in Missoula, Montana in 58 when Jack McKeon was my playing manager, that was a big year for my development.
Boy, all the stories are in the book, as Jim puts the words to the story, to the numbers, as I like to say. It's a great baseball story. Well, you end up with the Senators, and you get called up, and it's always a good story, no matter who we talk to, of getting that first call to the big leagues. Now, you're in Chattanooga, which was a big farm club for the Senators, and you get the call up. How was that?
Well, you know, it was a bit surprising because I started out that year, 1959, with the Double-A Chattanooga Lookouts. And I was, you know, kind of a power pitcher over the top. I set the strikeout record in the Southern Association with 19. And then the next game, I struck out the first four. And I felt something in my shoulder. You know, we didn't have MRIs or X-rays. We just, oh, I got a little twinge there. It doesn't feel right. And I wasn't throwing with my natural motion. And my arm, they said, oh, take 10 days off, 2 weeks, whatever. And I did. And then I came back. But my arm angle was never the same. And so one day Red Marion, the manager, calls me and he said, kid, you're going to the big leagues. And I said, that's great, but do they know that I'm not the pitcher that I was like a month ago? And he said, oh, you go up there and tell them about it. Now, that would never happen today, obviously, as they scrutinize their talent. But so my debut was not very impressive, and they did notice the difference. I had a little fatty cyst in between my ribs that was kind of causing my arm angle to drop. So, you know, that was my call up to the big leagues. I subsequently had that removed and got back where I should be, and then started the season with them in 1960.
Well, your manager was Cookie Lavaggetto, and we know that name in the Bay Area, of course, a longtime Bay Area baseball icon and had the big hit in the 47 World Series. And we've had his son, Ernie Lavaggetto, on the show before. But Cookie was your manager. How about that?
Yeah, Cookie was so good to me. You know, I tried out with the Senators in Chicago in 1957. And, you know, he said, kid, you sign with us, you'll be on my staff in 2 years. So driving home with my dad to my hometown in Michigan, I was all like, I said, you know, he said, I'll be in the big leagues in 2 years. And of course, my dad was trying to temper my enthusiasm a little. So, well, you know, he might say that to a lot of young kids to encourage him. But, you know, I did get to the big leagues, and Cookie was so good to me and gave me an opportunity. I did have to go back to the minor leagues in 1960 for a couple months, but yeah, he was a good manager for me to start my career with.
It's always interesting to hear about your first game in the big leagues. What was that like?
Well, that was the debut where I really knew I wasn't the pitcher that they had seen in spring training and that I was early in the year. It was against the 1959 White Sox, who won the World Series that year. So the first guys I faced were like Louis Aparicio and Nellie Fox. I only lasted a couple of innings. And then I had the procedure to take that fatty cyst out of my back. And then I did get to start a game on the last day of the season. They just threw all us rookies out there and said, split it up each pitch an inning or two. And I got a chance to face Ted Williams for the first time. So even though he hit me pretty hard those first couple at-bats, I did get him out the next year and honored that I became a real good friend of his. Got to spend a lot of time with Ted. But that was my first game in the big leagues and my first couple months there, really.
Yeah, 59, that White Sox team, of course, went to the World Series to play the Dodgers. And Bill Veeck was the architect of all the entertainment with that ball club in 59. Remember Bill Veeck?
I sure do. When I got traded, or actually the White Sox picked up my contract in 73, and I had a couple really good seasons then, and when he bought the club, the first move he made with not my permission, but with approval sort of, is that they wanted to get some young players, and the first deal he made, he traded me to the Phillies that year, which was a nice move for me. And then his son, I think, still operates a minor league team in St. Paul, but oh, I remember Bill very well. In fact, in my off-season job, we had to get jobs in the off-season those days. I was doing radio work, and I interviewed him. He came in to speak at Augsburg College. And now, this is 1964. I said, Mr. Veeck, could you tell me about the state of baseball? What do you think about it? He said, well, it starts too early, it ends too late, there's too much in between. And he said, what's really going to hurt the owners in the long run is the high cost of mediocrity. And he said that back in 1964. That's pretty prescient.
Well, one of the stories I remember reading about and hearing you tell was with Bill Veeck, Louis Armstrong was there in between games of the doubleheader playing the trumpet, and you were a musician too.
Yeah, I was an old trumpet player in high school, but that was, he brought Louis, and he brought a lot of entertainment in it between games of a doubleheader. I was starting the second game. Louis Armstrong, on kind of a flatbed truck, I think it was out there in the middle of the diamond, performing before games of the doubleheader. So, yeah, he had the first exploding scoreboard. So right. He was quite a promoter.
Well, the Senators moved to Minnesota, and all this is in the book, and it really details how you felt about it. And did you have an inkling that they were going to go to Minnesota? And, of course, they get to Minnesota, and the weather's a little bit different for you.
Yeah, we had no inkling at all. I was in the Instructional League in the fall of 1960. That's a developmental league down in Florida. Showed up one morning, and they said, well, we're no longer the Washington Senators. We're the Minnesota Twins. And we started talking about how the Braves moved from Boston to Milwaukee and what a great move it was for them. Little things like, hey, these guys got a car to drive during the summer from some of the dealerships. We thought that was a big deal. And it was really a positive move for us because, it was the first year of big league baseball in Minnesota, and there were such great fans to welcome us in. There was not a lot of high expectations because we were a last place team, but in 5 years' time, we stopped the Yankee streak there in 1965 and went to the World Series. So that was just a great time in my career playing there for 13 years.
Well, you were lucky enough to face Koufax three times in the 1965 World Series. How about that? And the stories are in the book.
I don't know if I'd say lucky enough, but it was quite a thrill, and I'm honored that Sandy and I have been, friends, acquaintances. He stays pretty private, but I've been able to be in his company several times. But, there's a humorous side to that, is that Sandy started game two because of the Jewish holiday. And so Drysdale started game one, and we knocked him around pretty good. And when Walter Alston came out to take the ball, Drysdale looked at him and said, I bet you wish I was Jewish, don't you? But I remember warming up in the bullpen on a cold, gray day, and I'd never seen Sandy pitch in person because, the only game on TV was Saturday, and we were playing at the same time. So it was pretty impressive to watch him warm up. And he turned to me at one time and said, do you really play in this weather? Because it was cold and rainy. I thought, man, that's the best chance we have. And after we went through the batting order the first time, I looked at, I sat next to my pitching coach, Johnny Sain. I said, John, if I give up a run, this game's over. Nobody can hit this guy. And, you know, we squeezed out two runs, one earned, and then we did win that game 5-1. But he, and we just got two runs off him, but he shut us out in game five, and then he shut us out in game seven on 2 days rest. No walks, 10 strikeouts, couldn't throw a curve after the fifth inning. And he told his catcher, Johnny Roseboro, who also caught for me for a while in Minnesota, he said, I can't throw a curve. And I guess Rosie said, what do you want to do? He said, I'm just going to blow him away. And that's what he did. We couldn't touch him. So it was, you know, disappointing to lose to the Dodgers, but it was pretty impressive to watch who I think was the greatest pitcher in my baseball era.
Mm. Jim Cott with us, winner of 283 Major League games, and, of course, he is in the Hall of Fame. Washington, Minnesota, then to the White Sox. And just touching on that briefly, it's a good story in the book about your relationship with Richie Dick Allen.
Yeah, I really enjoyed playing with Dick. You know, I was so fortunate. Roland Heeman claimed me off the waiver list. I had broken my wrist in 72, and I didn't get off to a very good start in 73. And the Twins had some young pitchers. Burt Blyleven, of course, was fast becoming their ace. And so they put me on waivers. Roland Heeman picked me up. And Chuck Tanner was our manager, who was, you know, the most positive baseball man I'd ever been around. And I got reunited with my pitching coach, Johnny Sain. So he worked a little magic with me, and I ended up having two 20-game seasons there when I think most really thought that my career was over. But playing with Dick was quite an experience. You know, we use the term generational players. Dick Allen was a legendary player. I mean, the wind would be blowing in from Comiskey, and everybody say, oh, nobody's going to hit one out of here tonight. And of course, Dick is famous for that, wearing his batting helmet with a cigarette dangling out of his mouth on the cover of Sports Illustrated. And he'd look at me with a wink, and he'd just drive it right through the wind. You know, I think walk-up music started with Dick, as he was having that phenomenal season in 72. And he came to bat, and Nancy Faust, the organist, just started playing Jesus Christ Superstar. And the next thing you know, he knocks one in the upper deck. And so every time he came up, that's the song they played. That might have been the start of walk-up music.
Hmm. Boy, we can thank him for that. Okay, very good. I love the part of the book, and the story's great, about you and Dick Allen going to Kentucky to see Secretariat. How about that?
Yeah, you know, he was that was a bond we had, too, as we both liked thoroughbred racing, and his brother Hank has been a long-time trainer. He was the first African-American trainer to take a horse to the Derby. And so one day I said to Dick, now, I got a car rented. We're going to get up early tomorrow. It was my first year in the National League. And so we were in Cincinnati. And I said, we're going out to see Big Red. Well, Big Red was the name for Secretariat, who was the Triple Crown winner in 73. So we got up and drove out and saw Secretariat. And, you know, fast forward, when I was Dick's teammate with the Phillies, I drove out to his farm after the season, and we each took a pitchfork and went mucked out his stall where he had his racehorse Briar Bend. And man, if we'd had a microphone in that stall, we really talked some great baseball for a while about what he learned from Gene Mock and what I learned from different people, you know, inside baseball that I think would be very interesting to players and baseball people today.
Well, those kinds of things are in the book. It's Good as Gold, my 8 decades in baseball. Jim Cott, along with Doug Lyons, put it together. Then you're off to the Phillies, and, of course, it's a very strong team and just can't get over the hump to get to the World Series.
Yeah, after the 75 season, Roland Heeman, our general manager, said, you know, you've had two good seasons, but Mr. Allen is losing money. We weren't drawing a lot of people. And he really thinks you're due for a sizable raise, but we think we could get some young players for you. And there's three teams in the National League that are looking for a veteran pitcher, the Mets, the Pirates, and the Phillies. And if you had your choice, where would you like to go? And as you said, the Phillies were a strong team, getting better every year. And I said, boy, I'd really like to go play for that Philly team. And then Mickey Lolich went to the Mets, and Doc Medich went to the Pirates, and I ended up going to the Phillies. And I didn't have great individual years, but those were three We won 100 games 2 years, I think 98 the other year, but those were talent-wise the best teams I was on. We couldn't quite get past the Reds in 76, and then the Dodgers beat us in 77, 78, even though we'd won the division each year. So I really enjoyed my time in Philly.
Nice. Your career continues through the Yankees and, of course, the World Series champions with the Cardinals. But I want to jump ahead just a little bit in the book to your broadcasting career. Now, this wasn't foreign to you. You were a good speech student as a kid, and you got the opportunity to be a broadcaster.
Yeah, I mentioned one of my off-season jobs was I did high school basketball and football play-by-play. And, you know, in the days before cable television, if there was a rain delay, they might call a player up to the booth just to visit and kill some time before they went to alternative programming in future years. And so Richie Ashburn and Harry Callis called me up one day during a rain delay at Wrigley Field. And a young man named Jody Shapiro was with one of the producers of that particular broadcast. And he said, well, you ought to think about getting into this business. Well, you know, I was still interested in playing. I played for a few years after that. But in 1981, we had the baseball strike. And so Jody was now running Home Team Sports, the cable outfit that televised the Baltimore games. So he called and he said, how would you like to do some minor league games with Ralph Kiner? My first game was actually with Rochester when Cal Ripken was the shortstop and Mike Boddicker was the pitcher, starting pitcher. So that's kind of where I got my start. I did about five or six games there. And then when my playing career ended, I ended up doing some college games for ESPN. And it, you know how that drill is. You make a tape and you start putting feelers out to different people, and things just worked out pretty well for me.
Well, now we can hear you on the MLB Network as well with Bob Costas. Jim, it's a pleasure having you on. We could talk for about another hour about your about your career, but the book is a lot of fun, and you can tell fans from the questions and the answers that, as I said, Jim gives life to the statistics and really the story of baseball. So I appreciate it. It's a great book, and we support our local independent bookstores, and we have the Book Tree up in Montclair, I'm sure, as well as other outlets where you can get the book. So, Jim, I appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Marty. I enjoyed it, and please say hi to Crook and Kipe for me, too. Terrific guys that are good friends, and I think one day they should go in as a pair to the broadcast wing of the Hall of Fame.
Boy, I agree with that. Jim, thanks so much. That is Jim Cott, and the book is Good as Gold, My 8 Decades in Baseball. More coming up. KMBR 680, 104.5, the sports leader.